Hi, I'm Donna Liu, and you're listening to A Grey Matter, the neuroscience podcast from the Queensland Brain Institute.
A couple of days after that, she said, "You know, Michael, how you bought me that coffee the other day, do you think you could, instead of coffee, substitute it with some whiskey?"
Our focus for this episode is dementia. We'll be talking about Alzheimer's disease in particular, its effects, and the promising research scientists at QBI are doing in order to find a cure.
Alzheimer's disease
is fast becoming the greatest medical challenge of the 21st century.
Alzheimer's strips bits off you until there's not much of you left.
What do you think can be done?
Research is the answer. Research is the answer.
There's still no known way to prevent, cure, or delay the progression of Alzheimer's. It affects individuals regardless of wealth or ethnicity, with notable sufferers like the late US President Ronald Reagan and English fantasy author Terry Pratchett, who featured in that last clip as part of Alzheimer Research UK's Fight Back campaign. Although the terms are used interchangeably, Alzheimer's disease and dementia aren't the same thing. Dementia refers to a broad category of brain conditions that cause impairment to functions like memory, language, personality, and cognitive skills. In Australia, there are currently over 300,000 people living with dementia. If there's no medical breakthrough, it will affect nearly 1 million Australians by 2050. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia and accounts for about 7 in 10 cases. Sahanya Rafal, Deputy Director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, is all too familiar with the ineluctable deterioration of Alzheimer's. For 7 years, she cared for her mother Carmel, who was formally diagnosed in her 70s. Before Alzheimer's, Carmel was known for her joie de vivre.
She was a very lively person, very engaged with all aspects of life, from politics to literature, and music was her passion. She always explored every corner of music, from new music, jazz. She was a trained classical pianist. She learned clarinet because she wanted to also play jazz, so she was curious about the world.
There's a body of research that suggests that being bilingual delays the onset of Alzheimer's disease by 4 years on average. In a 2010 article published in the journal Science, Pulitzer Prize-winning scientist and science writer Jared Diamond explains the phenomenon. He writes, "A short answer is the aphorism, use it or lose it. Exercising body systems improves their function. Not exercising them lets their function deteriorate. That's why athletes and musicians practice. It's also why Alzheimer's patients are encouraged to play brain-challenging games like bridge or to solve Sudoku puzzles. But bilingualism is arguably the most constant practice possible for the brain. Whereas even a Sudoku fanatic can spend only a fraction of a day on Sudoku puzzles, bilinguals impose extra exercise on their brain every minute of their waking hours. Consciously or unconsciously, the bilingual brain constantly has to decide, shall I think, speak, or interpret sounds spoken to me according to the arbitrary rules of language A or language B?" While languages and cognitive exercises can delay the onset of the condition, it's important to note that they can't prevent Alzheimer's altogether. Carmel, Sahanya's mother, was fluent in 4 languages.
She's a Sri Lankan woman, so she was always bilingual in English and Sinhalese. But she learned German and French because she, again, wanted to engage with particular aspects of history and the history of music in certain places. So she felt language was a very important part of accessing that life.
Sahanya believes that her mother had started showing the signs of Alzheimer's long before Sahanya herself found out.
My father was a doctor, and I think he was very aware that my mother had begun to show early signs of Alzheimer's. But together, I feel as if they colluded in not making that more visible to us, her children. One of the first major signs of that loss of memory, and something that my father shared with us, was when my mother went to listen to a concert in the opera house in an afternoon. They lived in West Ryde in Sydney, and she would often catch the train in and go in and listen to music or engage with the Writers' Festival, whatever. And she would come back, and they'd made a date to meet at the West Ryde Library and in the afternoon once she'd finished her concert. And Dada was waiting for her. She came very late. in the company of a local shopkeeper in West Ryde Station who happened to know my mum and dad and had found her lost and trying to find the library, a place that she was so familiar with. And so very clearly she couldn't remember her way from the station to the library.
Becoming disoriented, even in well-known places, is a common sign of Alzheimer's, as is when an individual loses enthusiasm for activities they previously enjoyed.
How did she respond to music as her dementia progressed?
Early parts of dementia, we were able to really engage. She learned a lot of Satie at that time.
That's Eric Satie, the French avant-garde composer.
Which was quite, it's challenging music. But by the end, she completely was uninterested in music.
Did she respond in any way when it was played to her?
No.
That's really unfortunate.
It was very, very, very sad because I remember teaching Rahul, our oldest son, the impromptus, which were some of her most favorite pieces of music, and getting him to play them to her at the home, and she just fell asleep.
No response.
No response at all.
Tell us about the major breakdown that she had.
The major breakdown, it's very, very funny in hindsight, and even at the time we did have a giggle about it. At about midnight or one in the morning, my father called us here at home and said, "Daughter, you've got to come at once. There's a problem with your mother." And that's all he said. He didn't elaborate at all. So my husband, Michael, and I, we drove to the Ashgrove apartment, and Mama was in the garage in her nightdress, sitting in the passenger seat. Well, not sitting, she was lying in the passenger seat because she'd put the back down, so she was horizontal. And the only way I could speak to her was by getting into the driver's side and sitting there, and she just said, "Darling, you've got to find a hole in the ground for me." And I said, "A hole in the ground? But Mama, it's one in the morning. I can't possibly find a hole in the ground at this time of night." She said, "Well, you have to. Surely there must be a decent hole in the ground close by." And I said, "Well, no, I don't think it's that easy to find." And so we had this little banter going up and down until I said to her, it was such a ridiculous conversation really to be having. I said, "Mama, this is like the script from a Goon Show episode." And we both had a big laugh about it because it was such a mad conversation. And I said, let's go in and have a cup of tea and discuss this in the morning. It's time to go to bed anyway. After the hole in the ground, while she was in the institution, she formed she was always very close to Michael, my husband, but he became like her little confidant. And she would often call him during the day and say, "Michael, I really feel like a coffee. Can you bring me some coffee?" So one day, he'd bring her a flask of hot coffee and they'd spend the afternoon together. And, you know, a couple of days after that, she said, "You know, Michael, how you bought me that coffee the other day, do you think you could, instead of coffee, substitute it with some whiskey, but not tell anyone?" Because she was well aware that was not, she was not allowed to, well, we were not allowed to bring alcohol into the facility. And you know, she would, there was another time when she, one of the other people facility had tattoos, and she was really taken up with the tattoo and piercings, and she called Michael to say she really wanted to go to the valley to get a tattoo and her nose and her ears pierced again because she really felt like doing that. So she became childlike in many ways and mischievous. But in many ways, it was her last real moment of insight, I think, about the degradation of her mind. And she was And it's you know, a hole in the ground is to bury her. It was her way of saying, I don't want to live like this anymore. But that was her big, you know, crash, and she never recovered from that. And we had to institutionalize her for 7 years after that before she passed away. And it was a steady decline to the point where at the end she barely spoke. Even though she perfectly understood everything we said to her. And this was a woman who was so active, so alert, so articulate, so engaged with so much of life's great, wonderful things.
Carmel Raffel died in her sleep last year.
I think Alzheimer's disease is a devastating disease because it destroys our personality, basically what makes us what we are.
That's Professor Jürgen Gotz, the director of the Clem Jones Centre for Ageing Dementia Research here at QBI. Earlier this year, they had a breakthrough in treating Alzheimer's mice with ultrasound. Now bear with me if you're already aware of the mechanisms of the disease. In Alzheimer's, there's an abnormal buildup of a protein called beta amyloid, which forms plaques outside brain cells. There's also a buildup of a protein called tau inside brain cells, which form what are called tangles. Put simply, these proteins accumulate, damage connections between neurons, and cause cell death.
So basically what we found is that by taking mice with a pronounced amyloid pathology at a relatively advanced age and treating them with a scanning mode of ultrasound, and opening the blood-brain barrier by prior injection of micron bubbles, and things get into the brain and out of the brain. And by using the scanning mode and doing it over a period of 6 to 8 weeks weekly, we found that amyloid was reduced massively, not completely, but massively. But this partial reduction in amyloid was sufficient to restore memory functions to wild-type levels in three complementary tests.
By wild-type levels, Professor Gotz means that the treated dementia mice showed the same memory functions as healthy mice of the same age. The huge advantage of using ultrasound is that it's non-invasive and relatively cheap. The next goal is to upsize the treatment for trials on bigger animals with thicker skulls.
So we hope that we can develop a device and a method which allows us to treat human patients.
To raise much-needed funds for Alzheimer's research, the Queensland Brain Institute is teaming up with Hand Heart Pocket, the charity of Freemasons Queensland, as well as with Alzheimer's Australia, to host a gala evening this Friday, the 31st of July, at Customs House in Brisbane.
The program includes performances from award-winning and internationally renowned musicians, as well as a special address by Ita Buttrose, Alzheimer's Australia's National Ambassador. If you're interested, tickets are still selling and there's a link in the description of this podcast.
I'm Donna Lou and that's all for this episode. Let us know what you think or if you have any requests for future podcasts. We're on Twitter at QBI_UQ and on Facebook, or you can give us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.